It's a Thursday, so therefore I've got Anne Lord Jackson in front of me. Hello, Anne.
Hello, great to be here.
Sensory health. Now, we've talked about sensory freedom a little while ago, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Because I like that idea. I think sensory health, it's one of those things, perhaps we think, oh, it's that person's problem over there, but it does affect us all. And I just love the thing that came from that prayer group you had about sensory freedom, because it keeps on going around my head.
Oh, well, that's really special, but because that is the essence of everything. When you know who you are, when you know who others are, and when you know what to expect, what not to expect, when you are equipped and empowered to handle these things, then you can relax and have that sense of freedom in the life that you have and the things that you do and how you do it. And that is a lovely thing. It is a lovely thing.
I just thought it might be nice to touch a little bit on your motivation behind what you're doing. Clearly, you're trained as an occupational therapist. So there's, is it a degree at some point back in the past? Is it a degree?
Yeah.
So you've done a qualification. You've trained to be an occupational therapist. How did you move towards being in a specialized, I guess, part of that with the sensory health? What was the decision? Because obviously the OT part affects the sensory health part and vice versa. But what led you into wanting to do sensory health as a kind of specialty within occupational therapy?
Oh, that's good. Because I also termed the phrase sensory health as well. I didn't know anybody else that had used it, but I felt I wanted to move out of the medical model, which is very much the occupational therapy side of it, and think the way that we think about our emotional health and our mental health and our physical health, that sensory health was just as important as just abundant health. That's what we want to live in. That's what we feel, you know, we all aspire to, and that's all what's right. But in 1993, if I get the dates right, yeah, it was 1993, I was in Belgium working as an occupational therapist and working in a center for children with autism and who were deaf. So it was a really interesting combination. And within there, that was when I had my first experience of sensory processing that really made me want to go into it. I came up to this boy who was sitting on a PE bench. I came up to him way too quickly, too unexpectedly, and he flew off the bench. So I sidled up, you know, sideways as you do. He flew off the bench and was kicking and screaming all on the floor, and I didn't know what I'd done, and the occupational therapist there said, well, he's tactile defensive, and I didn't have a clue what that was at the time. So that was the start of me being able to want to find out more about sensory processing. So it was another 11 years of study to actually go through all the various levels, being an advanced practitioner, getting a postgraduate diploma, still working on a master's degree at the moment, but it was full, just anything that I could do, anything that I could find out about sensory processing and integration was what I went to, because it made such a difference. So this little boy who, when I had come up to him too fast on the PE bench, they used to take them on bouncy castles in this school. It was a remarkable, well, it was a rehabilitation center, that was its name. But what, you know, so this little fella who couldn't have me close to him on a PE bench, when we were on the bouncy castles, he could cope with people bumping into him. And it was just like, that doesn't make sense. How can that happen? So then when I learned about the neural pathways and the nerve pathways and how things work, I thought, oh, right, okay, now I understand it. So we can tolerate certain sensations in certain circumstances if the sensory systems are well set up to be able to integrate and process sensations better. So yeah, that was a big learning curve, and to see the difference for myself with knowing nothing from that side of it, it was a real incentive for me to think, this is life changing and I want to be able to help people in this way. So yeah, 30 years later, here I am.
Wow. It reminded me actually of my work experience when I was at school. So here in the UK, you do work experience probably 15, 16 years old. As a rule, you do 2 weeks in something. It could be a business or a shop or whatever. Yes. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I had a friend who was a deputy head in a special needs school, as it was called back then. And I said, do you think I can come and work with you for a bit? So I went into 2 weeks in this additional needs school, where predominantly it was people with physical challenges. Either they're in a wheelchair, or they've got issues with their legs, they're stuck in a particular position, or it was predominantly physical restrictions of some sort. And obviously with that, of course, you're going to get some people who have some mental challenges because they've been in a car crash and whatever. But the one thing that struck me is I went in thinking, oh, I've got to be really gentle and delicate and calm and so, you know, and sort of small, you know, and treat them so carefully. And within about 18 seconds, I realized, no, they're just normal people. And I really had this view of what I would need to be in order to be with them. Mm. But having stepped inside that school and working there for, I mean, it was really quick, and I loved it, was these, they just want to be treated like normal people. So they have jokes, you know, they bash into each other's wheelchairs and see if they can knock each other over. And I'm thinking, you can't do that. But that's normal behavior. So why develop jokes about if you don't behave, I'll flatten your tires, you know? And it, in context, it makes sense. But I learned a lot about what some people can do and overcoming obstacles that to me are impossible, but they get through. And I think about that little lad that you sat next to who flew off because you needed to find a different shaped hole for that peg, didn't you? Because I guess in a sense you're going like I did with this is what I need to do, and no.
Yeah, and the fact that children want you to come up and you close and you cuddle them and that's kind of like what you do when they're little, obviously not when they're older, but that's what you do. And actually, no, you don't. With some you don't do that. But it was really, it is, I remember also feeling quite nervous the first time. It's a bit like yourself, just not knowing quite how do you talk to, how do you act? Like being with someone with different needs just makes you question how do you do this when you're just not used to it. And I think it's what's really good now is that there are so many people with so many disabilities, diagnoses, different ways of being that are so much part and parcel of school, that part and parcel of everyday life, that actually more people are getting familiar, much more familiar with treating people just as people, and very much that inclusion, that diversity, the integration of everybody in society to be valued, and that everybody matters. It's not just Black Lives Matter. It's not anybody else, you know, matters over anybody else. Everybody is so unique and so special. And the more we get used to interacting together, the less those fears, those boundaries, they just disappear over time, because actually there are no differences. Well, there are differences between us, but it's not anything that anybody's awkward about anymore. We just get used to relating to people with differences in different ways. And and then it becomes second nature and just so normal.
I know you like how my brain works because it sort of fires off in weird tangents, but I was thinking about the film Monsters, Inc. If you've not seen the film Monsters, Inc., it's basically these monsters. And the whole point of the film is the monsters have to scare children to get Scream energy so they can power their city. Okay, that's the basic premise of the film. But what I like in the film is all the chairs, all the seats, all the cars, all the houses, all the doors are shaped around a particular monster that lives in there or sits in there or drives that particular vehicle. And what I liked was it is a bit of a utopia. And in a cartoon, we can do that. Mm. But I liken what you're doing to being something in between the Monsters, Inc. utopia of every monster has their particular chair they can sit on because they've got three eyes or four legs or whatever. And what you're doing is saying, okay, well, let's work with that.
I have never had what I do compared. I love that, Andy. I absolutely love that. That is just so, it excites me hearing you talk about it. And I'm going to go back and look at Monsters, Inc. again. I hadn't even computed that that's what it does, but that's exactly what we'd love. You know, yeah, absolutely.
But since we can't have 150 million designs of chair or car or door, actually that's where you come in, because you say, okay, well, we can't do this, but we need to do this. So what's the shape? Let's get the right, you know, because it is literally taking a square peg and a round hole and just bashing it in society. You will fit. Mm. But, I mean, you're going to make so much damage to make it work.
Absolutely. We can take, and I agree there are times, I suppose, that in a way I'm a bit like a bit of sandpaper from the actual therapy perspective, because we there are elements that may just need to be tweaked a little bit from our peg, which is the individual themselves. So there is a degree of like a craftsmanship to change the shape, but not significantly enough that it changes the person. And that's the environment around that needs to change. so that we get correct fitting pegs in correct holes that are individualized and personalized. But yeah, I'll just be a little bit of a shaper or a shaver or hopefully a bit more of a master craftsman to help them fit better into the accommodations that society can make. It can't change completely. That utopia is quite unrealistic, but there are an awful lot of things that we can do to make life better for people.
Which I guess is where there's a bit of give and take, isn't there? I mean, in the film that I'm thinking of, I think about one of the guys who's got one eye and his glasses has one lens. We can help somebody who doesn't have an eye. We can kind of understand that to some extent. Mm. But if you've got someone with several legs, you know, they need an extra third shoe. Actually, we do have problems where someone has a differently sized foot to the extent that pair of shoes they're buying actually doesn't fit. Because that's a physical issue. But then we're talking about neurological and mental differences and struggles and adaptations that perhaps for most of us just make no sense. Like, why can't you just stick an instep in that shoe and make it work for yourself? But it doesn't work quite that simply.
Yeah, and the fact that the shoe size changes when we're dealing with sensory processing, some days individuals can work really well and they're a size five and they'll always stay a size five and that's it. And then the next day they've had a real rough night's sleep. The temperature's different that they wake up and it's almost like the shoe's grown or that their feet have grown to a size eight or they've shrunk to a size two. So it's, and then you're trying to fit the same thing and you think, well, you did this yesterday. Why can't you do it today? And actually the brain and the body is just processing things differently today. And that's where we need the nuances. That's where we need people to really understand about sensory processing because it changes on a day-to-day basis. You've not got just like your size five shoe and their size five foot, and that's going to be consistent all the time. I'm working with individuals who are inconsistent. And that is where the skill comes with working and empowering those around the individual and then themselves to be able to morph and you know, change the accommodations around how that individual is on that day.
A friend of mine, she had a cataract. So she was in her 80s, she had a cataract. And the point at which someone said, I really think you should get this checked out, is when she referred to a colour as the wrong colour. And it wasn't until she'd had the operation, she'd had the cataract removed, and she put on her grey jumper that was a really bright red. Because the cataract had, over time, changed her ability to recognise colour. And when she had the cataract removed, all of a sudden her grey jumper, that she thought was really boring, was this beautiful red colour. And that's a physical transformation. But what we're talking about with especially some of the work that you're doing, it's not that obvious. But somebody noticed that she was referring to colours incorrectly and she didn't understand why. The reason was she was literally looking through a filter that changed it. But we're talking about people who've got filters that are in the brain that we can't see and perhaps they can't even identify.
Yeah, and that's the skill. And one of the biggest things that we say in my world is see behaviour, think sensory. So if you're thinking, if you're just not sure where that behaviour is coming from, first look at sensory processing because it's the physical, like the fact that she literally had that, you know, that lens, that difference was affecting her colour. Not a physical lens, but that impact on her colour perception. And that's a physical thing that can be changed easily. So before we need to get into psychological issues or more complex work or this, that, and the other, let's just look at the senses because they are physical and they can be changed swiftly and easily if we treat them with sensory strategies. And then we can leave the harder work of whatever's left over afterwards.
Because off the back of her having a cataract operation, she wore glasses anyway, but the person that did the surgery said, look, you need some more glasses, but please don't get them until we've done the procedure to your eye. You need to live with the fact you can't see very clearly because once we take the cataract off, it's going to change the prescription for your eye to be able to see through glasses. And I guess in a similar way, what you're doing is sometimes you have to live with those glasses that are out of focus because you know what? There's more important stuff to deal with first.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that the sequence in which we do things is really important. So often telling folks, oh, please don't take the medication yet. Let me see what I can treat. Let's use the body's systems first, see what we can change, see if we can get you sleeping, eating, communicating better, getting more coordinated before you take external medications to help you in those things. And I'm not denying that they can't be helped by the medication, but it's just let's try and do what we can naturally. Let's get the body, you know, for the rest of its life, being able to function as best possible first.
There are some things that we're going to need some surgery for, a cataract, for example. So that's a physical external input into our life. But there are some things that we can do, and it's always going to be better for us to learn, I guess, how to manage something without medication, without surgery, because they all carry risks that are, I suppose, greater than what we can physically try and do ourselves.
Yeah. Always is. And then you're not dependent on anything. The only thing that you're dependent on is you being able to feel what's going on within you, to sense your own senses, sense your own sensory processing, and then have the various strategies that you can pick on. Because today, what you might choose to do today will be different to what you choose tomorrow, because your actual nervous system has morphed. Going back to that, it changed from one day to the next. You need to have a toolkit of things that are available and not just have that one pill that you take every day, because how you function can be different day to day.
So, how do you deal with somebody who presents and it's just, to anybody else, what you're seeing is just aggressive behavior, or maybe not so much violence, maybe that's a bit extreme, but what we're seeing is really something quite hard and most of us would want to walk away. Mm. How do you overcome, I suppose, I'm not saying people walk in threatening, I don't mean that, but somebody walks in, you're thinking, gosh, this is really hard, this isn't very pleasant. How do you overcome that? Because you said see the senses, treat the, well, off of what you said now.
See behaviour, think sensory.
Thank you. Much clearer than what I was trying to say. So how do you do that when it's somebody who isn't walking in polite and courteous and all the rest of it? Mm. Either because it's a really, really angry husband because they can't cope anymore with their wife, exhausting because they're clumsy all the time, and it's not clumsy, it's a sensory issue. How do you then try and overcome your own, like what you can see, issues, which most of us would say, no, I can't do that. How do you overcome that?
Yeah, I think because the heart of compassion, I think possibly more than anything, that recognizing that most behavior is communication. So there's always something behind it. And I'm not afraid. Well, I do stay away, because actually, you talk about violence. Actually, violence is a regular part of my day.
Oh, okay.
Only because of the children that I see and that I liaise with. So I'm not physically always in the room with them, but I'm dealing with people who are dealing with violent individuals on a fairly daily basis. But when I'm actually there, it is staying away, but it's not being afraid, because of recognizing that there are, yeah, you keep a certain distance, because if you don't want to be physically assaulted, that's kind of like number one. And making sure that you're towards the door, you position yourself well. That's a whole nother ball game when you're actually in the room with someone who's getting physically agitated, how you would position yourself and so on. But understanding that there is a reason behind it. And because I'm always in my head thinking, what are the sensory aspects that could have been feeding into this, either leading up to it during their day, or what is actually going on at the moment? So if there are sounds outside, if there are sights outside the window, if there's fluorescent lighting, if there's too much busyness going on, I just kind of like do a scan, like a sensory scan of the environment, to think what is it that could be affecting them at this moment in time, and then seeing if there are any strategies, either by changing the environment or by encouraging the individual. If I can start to see they're getting more agitated, if there are certain physical things that we can do to help bring their arousal levels down so that they don't start to lose it. And actually do get aggressive. But it's very, I think almost I'm always seeing that behavior, something isn't right in them if they are starting to get violent or agitated or really unsettled. It's just like, and knowing that if I don't stay calm, it's only going to escalate the system, situation. It's only going to make things worse if I don't stay calm. So.
I guess somebody could be coming quite calm. And what for one child might be, oh, great, there's a lorry and it's got a skip on the back, and that might be really exciting to see it offloaded. For another child, that could just be overload of noise and sound and processing. And all of a sudden, they've flipped in a way that is contradictory to what we might assume would be natural.
Yeah. Yeah. So simple thing, just closing the window if the windows are open, opening the window if it's closed, because it could be heat that could be getting them. We can't make general assumptions at all. It's always, I have a very questioning mind wherever I go, whoever I'm with. I make very few assumptions about what anybody is going through.
What a world would we live in if we ask questions rather than make statements about what we see? There's a thought to ponder. Okay, have you got a recent success story? Have you got anybody who's completed something you're doing that, and it's like, or just a light bulb moment of, this works?
Oh my word, my word! I just know. I had a call this morning with one of the schools. It's not a success yet, but it will be, only because they're just utterly desperate, and it's just so lovely to be able to be there to help. It's just, we have this little, we think he's autistic, we think he's ADHD, we're not sure. But that doesn't matter. I haven't seen him yet. I haven't met the parents. I haven't done anything. But they're utterly desperate. And, you know, he's just not succeeding. You know, the parents are really stressed. And it's so precious. The success for me is that people know that I'm here and that they are engaging. So next week, we're hoping to meet school and family and myself. And we're going to say, look, this is the sensory super system. This is what I do. This is how I can support you. And just to hear the head teacher just being so positive about having something that she can offer her families, is that's for me the biggest success, to offer hope for people that actually there are ways and means, and there is a service that is actually there for them. She was just telling me like three different practitioners have just disappeared off over the time of the involvement with this family, and that they think something's going to happen, or they've just had a blanket, no, we can't do that, no, we can't do that, no, we can't do that. And it's just utterly precious to be able to think, crumbs, you know, God willing, I'm not going anywhere. I have this service. I have this system. It is clear. We've got a booklet that we work through. We've got online courses that you follow. We get communication between school and home, me bringing in the bit where I need to tweak and show them and help them interpret maybe some of the behaviors from a sensory perspective, give them those eyes to see things in a different way, and to know for the next year, we've got this agreement financially from the school, for the family. And that's the biggest success for me just this morning, because it's fresh, I suppose.
I can see the excitement as well that we can do something.
Yeah, we can do something. It was just like, you know, to think that crumbs, people just don't have this service. And I'm here thinking, I've got this service. I want to tell people. How do I tell people? That's why we communicate and we chat the way we do, because it's just letting folks know that if they are struggling with these things, they shouldn't be on their own. There is no need for them to struggle through alone. Or if they know anybody that is struggling, that then, you know, the service is here to support them.
Because I think that's one of the things, though, isn't it? When you've got a husband who's struggling and people are looking at you, when you've got your child and in a wheelchair and they're screaming because they can't cope, people make judgments. And I think the greater judgments are always going to be the parents. Having worked in children's ministry in churches, and parents like, oh, I can't come to church because my child will make a noise. Great. Bring your child and make a noise. It's okay. Yes, there are things that might be acceptable more than others, and things that probably wouldn't be acceptable. But let's work together and see how we can help you. But I think just being comfortable in your own skin as a parent, or because you've got a nephew or something, just to know, do you know, it's okay. But we need people who can say it's okay.
And in June, actually, for something that hopefully we'll get to talk about more, because I'm just in the process of planning at the minute. It's just putting out, we're going to meet for 6 weeks and help churches actually look at what you need to do, what you can do if you want to be more inclusive, if you want to be able to provide a space where people feel welcome, so that the families don't feel the pressure that they can't bring, or that it's too hard, it's too difficult to bring their children to church, or to bring their brother, their sister, maybe an older relative to church because of the needs that they have. So we'll be putting together a six-week program, June, July, into September, just to give people a bit of space and time. We'll only meet for 6 weeks over that period of time. But for me to be able to support people who genuinely do want to make a difference in their church culture, and that we can, it'd be great to be able to talk about that more. As it comes together.
baby steps. I would like to, because having been in churches and seeing some of it from the perspective of being in full-time ministry, sometimes you're so busy just trying to get through the day-to-day, the idea of fixing a problem, well, that'd be lovely. But where do I go? Where do I start? How do I do it? How much money is it going to cost? What will people like? Is it going to change? All these questions, and sometimes it's not that complicated, but when you're busy, and people in church ministry certainly are, just to have a helping hand of here's three things you can do, here's five things you can do, and they can pick something, I can do that, and they can identify with something to help them help the people who they want to help, but sometimes they're restricted by helping only in as much as I've got time for this, I've got time for that, but not really making a big difference. And there are things we can do, like you said, sort of sanding down the edges of some of the shapes, because we can't have a shape for everything, because you've got a finite amount of room and all that. But you know what? Actually, we can sort of go in different holes and different shapes with a little bit of tweaking, and a square hole and a peg that's round can work if it's the right size. It doesn't matter about the shape so much. We can find a way. But that's where people like you come in, which I love. So that's really great. Thank you, Anne, for another session. I didn't know where we were going today, but I sort of my brain fires, fascinating ways. I don't know. I got you and I got Dr. Scott, who's saying, you got an interesting brain, Andy. It's amazing where it goes to. But hey.
That's why you are so brilliantly placed in the job that you do. It's just brilliant.
Random brain fires. Right. There's a study on its own for a master's degree, Andy B's brain. Right. Thank you. If you want to know more about Anne and how she can help you in your office, in your church, in your home, in your community, in your doctor's surgery, or wherever, then you can find out more. Go to our website to get hold of her the best way, at pure247radio.org, pure247radio.org/ALJ. And you can get linked to Anne. Thank you, Anne.
That's brilliant. See you next time.
Bye for now.
Pure 247 Radio is listener supported, which means we are free, online, and always pure because of the generous support of our listeners. If you would like to contribute financially, please visit pure247radio.org. If you'd like to find out how we use your money, please visit the Our Cost section. Any donation of any size will help keep us on air and broadcasting for free. Thank you.